the tendency to persecute and condemn people who are simply different or who are behaving in ways thought to be inappropriate is woven throughout human history. People have been institutionalized, sterilized, and even murdered for the sin or crime of being different. They've been so singly and sometimes in horrifyingly large numbers. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. Stay with me while we talk with geneticist Elof Carlson about a topic he's researched and drafted a book for. The book is called The Unfit. We'll be talking about the unfit in the time to come. Dr. Carlson, the phrase the unfit isn't just a random phrase. It has a history, doesn't it? Can you tell me its origination?
It certainly does. It was widely used from the 1880s to about 1940 for a category of people, particularly in America, who were considered defective or degenerate. The term unfit carried with it both mental retardation, psychosis, chronic criminal arrest, vagrancy, pauperism, gambling, prostitution, a host of sins of social failure that were believed at that time to have a biological basis.
You used the word sin. This word isn't used lightly, I assume? Society thought these people were sinning in some way?
Yes, the history of it goes back much further than the United States. It has European roots, and in the European roots, particularly in the early part of the 19th century, the early 1800s, and even further back to the 1700s, the idea that people who were unfit or degenerate owed their defect to some act of sinning that led to their descendants' difficulties.
Let's work for the next few minutes on defining terms. The unfit is one, and we'll go into particulars on who those people are. Your book and your study concentrate on the development of the theory of eugenics and on
yes.
its consequences.
Yes.
So let's define that too. What's eugenics?
Eugenics was a term introduced at the turn of the century by an English scientist, Francis Galton. He took it in a very optimistic way. He was influenced by his cousin, Charles Darwin. So he thought that human evolution could be taken in our own hands, and he felt it a moral duty on the part of the more talented, the healthier, the more long-lived, to have larger family sizes than the average, and that this would be a benefit to civilization.
That's what we think of as positive eugenics.
That's correct.
The most extraordinary act of imposing negative eugenics on society in our time is Hitler's movement.
Oh, but it had its origins in the United States. Hitler picked up on a movement that began in the 1870s in the United States. It became worldwide shortly after the turn of the century. It entered into the Weimar Republic, and Hitler took it over.
Few people know this.
That's true. Many people think of the eugenics movement as primarily a 20th century development. And they usually think of it in Nazi terms, and certainly those are the most heinous abuses of the eugenics movement. But in England, it had a very idealistic movement. It wasn't coercive, and it wasn't intended to put people down. It was to elevate among the best more children from the best.
The title of your book, the full title with subtitle included, is The Unfit, From the Sin of Onan to the Smoke of Auschwitz. The Sin of Onan we'll get into in a minute. It is essentially masturbation.
Yes.
Onan biblically cast his seed upon the ground. God was displeased. Onan was slain. We'll take a look at that. I want to review, most people will know, but I also want to take a look at Hitler's definition. Who was unfit to Hitler and what did he do?
He outlined a racial theory of German people, and he wanted a purification of the Germanic people. He identified a 19th century idea of Aryan peoples as the founders of the Germanic people. These weren't limited to his own country. It included Northern Europe and Western Europe, so it included the English and included the Scandinavians. And it included people along the Baltic states. He felt that that genetic material should be cleansed of the contamination of breeding with Southern Europeans, with Eastern Europeans, and particularly a group that he singled out as destructive to what he called German blood, where the idea of heredity was in the blood, the Jews. And he looked upon the Jews as a parasitic corruption on European society, so he singled them out the most for destruction. His long-range plans with Himmler were to not only get rid of the Jews, but to get rid of Poles and Russians. He hated the Slavs, and he wanted them all sterilized if he had won the war, to serve as slave laborers and eventually to die out.
Added to those groups, homosexuals were murdered. Also people of different political beliefs to Hitler, those who defied his right.
Yes. That was a second aspect. He said that in addition to these foreign elements, there was a corruption from within, and he wanted all German births in the future to be as healthy as possible. He didn't want children with birth defects to survive, and he didn't want people with who had children with birth defects to be the parents of the new generation of Germany. So there were great plans, if Hitler had won the war, for a massive positive eugenic program based on the Aryan type. And they were collecting blonde, blue-eyed peoples from the countries that they conquered and bringing them back. Particularly women who would then become the mothers of children for the SS.
Which led to some genetic experimentation.
Yes.
Yeah. This is Conversations. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. Today we're talking with Dr. Elof Carlson. He teaches biochemistry at also cell biology at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Is a distinguished teaching professor there, also master of the Honors College at that university. We'll hear more about Dr. Carlson as we go along. I said a minute ago that we'd take a look at the victims more fully. I think it's important to get the brunt of what the eugenics movement has proposed and also the people that it has despised along the road. You've pointed out in your lecture that there were groups isolated by different books of the Bible who were considered unfit ages ago. Can we take a look at what the Old Testament had to say?
Yes, the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Deuteronomy and to some extent in Genesis, describes categories of unfit people. Unlike the 19th century or 20th century unfit, these were considered unfit because of transgressions against the religion of the Jews,
a
against
sort of
the Bible.
Original sin.
Yeah. Perhaps one can use that term, although we usually think of original sin as a Christian doctrine rather than a Jewish doctrine. But what these were I'll give you a few examples. There's one young man described in Deuteronomy who is called an unruly and disobedient child. And if that child is unmanageable and the parents both denounce the child to the Jewish court, the Jewish court holds a trial in front of the parents' house. And if the community agrees that this child growing up will be a menace to the community, then the adults have to stone the child to death. There's been a lot of debate among Talmudic scholars to what extent this was ever practiced. There may have only been one or two instances, and some believe that it was more of a scare story to discipline children.
Yeah.
That's one example. The second example is a group of people called the Amalekites, who are a branch of the Philistines. And the Philistines, of course, are names in both the Christian and Jewish tradition of a people that were considered loathsome and corrupt. But the Amalekites hectored the Jews as they were fleeing across the desert. And Moses was constantly reminded by God in his conversations not to forget to exterminate the Amalekites, all of them, including their children and their cattle. The Amalekites were also considered among the Jews to have interbred and spread around the world. So in some of the Jewish groups, when a particularly evil person arises, like Ferdinand, who expelled the Jews in 1492, or Hitler, the Jews say that those individuals have Amalekite blood.
Hmm. You're a geneticist.
Yes.
But it seems to me in researching this book, you can't help but have wondered why, on the philosophical end, we do these things. Do you have a sense of what it is about us that we pick groups of people, call them untouchable, unfit, and prescribe remedies, the most gruesome in some cases?
Yeah, I have a theory. I don't know how good it is. Living is always complex because life is more complicated than we want it to be. And we are continually disappointed when our expectations are frustrated. And when we look around us and see people who are failures, we sometimes wonder, why did they fail and why did I succeed when I had rough times and I managed to get by? And it's easier to blame the victim and say that person failed because there's something wrong with that person's heredity, or there's something about that person's type if they differ racially, or something about that person's religion, and we feel that it's a corruptive set of behavior compared to what we have. So for a variety of social reasons, where we are successful, we tend to look upon the failures as somehow bringing about their own misery.
And then we condemn them for their failure and for their weakness.
And generalize that it will extend to their descendants. And that's where the danger of a hereditary basis to it comes in.
I know you're basically an optimist. You've said as much. But do you think we're getting any better at this?
Yes, I do. Because, things like witchcraft and slavery have virtually disappeared from the world. And these were institutions that lasted for millennia. So human beings can learn. Sometimes it takes them a long time to learn. But the more we are educated, the more we reflect on the abuses of the past, the more we develop a sense of moral responsibility among our children, the better off society becomes.
Are we not practicing a sort of residual genetics still in our time, dramatically in China against the Tibetan Buddhists, in some ways in the United States, with people who are poor, people who are different, people who are new to this country?
Yes, these do exist. And I think it's very difficult to leap into some sort of utopian situation. We end up with temporary setbacks or temporary problems. The Chinese might right now kill off more daughters than sons. They usually do it by infanticide rather than prenatal diagnosis, and then they deny that they're doing the infanticide, but the ratio of males to females shows that that's exactly what they're doing. And that's primarily in the rural areas, and that's because China has a one-child policy. So the daughters who are born, half of all births, are vulnerable to those families that want sons. But that will change as the opportunities for women increase in those third world countries. And where the women become the prime ministers or elected presidents, where the women become chief executive officers of corporations, where the women are lawyers and physicians and professors, the need to have sons as a way of family prestige or a way of family financial success will wither as a forgotten tradition of the past.
Some of us would say that's a long-term evolution.
It is a long-term evolution, but I've always felt that social evolution works much faster than biological evolution, and we are very fortunate that we have the capacity to think and control our destinies.
Once again, this is Dr. Elof Carlson. He has written over 90 publications at my quick count, at least three books on the subject of genetics and a biography of the man who invented the X-ray, is that accurate, Mueller?
Who first used X-rays to induce mutations, the father of radiation genetics.
The title of that book is?
Genes, Radiation, and Society, The Life and Work of Hermann Muller.
Thank you. This is Dr. Elof Carlson, and I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to take a quick walk, we won't do it justice, but a relatively quick walk through the evolution of the eugenics movement. It began not in the United States, but was picked up and pushed forward in the United States.
Yes.
So you really begin in some ways with the beliefs and biases of the Bible.
Yes.
When you go back to it. Bring us over to these shores and take us forward.
Sure. In the United States there are two movements that began in the mid-19th century. One was a social reform movement, people like Dorothea Dix, who had a great deal of compassion for the insane, felt that they shouldn't be chained or treated as a disgrace to society. And she helped develop the asylum care movement. Social reformers who had utopian communities in the United States believed that good environments could eventually make this a wonderful heaven on earth in North America. The other movement that began at approximately the same time that urbanization began to get very dense in our cities was the frustration that social reforms failed. Paupers in the impoverished areas of the cities were difficult to manage. They didn't get out of their pauperism. Their conditions led to ill health, so this forced the municipalities to develop public hospitals. Mm-hmm. And that cost the citizens money. And if the social reforms failed and the problems increased the burden on everybody else, many people protested and wanted some way of getting out of this trap. And one way of getting out of this trap was to look at the people who were impoverished and otherwise a failure in society as degenerate in some way, and an attempt to reduce their numbers in the population. That is what we call the negative eugenics movement. It was born before the term eugenics and actually existed in the United States.
And when you say proposed some solution, what?
Well, the first attempts were isolation, that they would be shunned, that people wouldn't want to marry into their families, and that eventually, through this shunning movement, they would get smaller and smaller and eventually disappear. But then there was the fear that this wouldn't happen because of private charity, almsgiving, and the like, and then these people would reproduce in larger and larger numbers and be unrestrained, and as a result they would spread over their borders and swamp out the good stock of America. And that was the concern of those who wanted more drastic measures. And these drastic measures included containment in prisons or asylums where they would be sexually isolated and therefore couldn't reproduce. And then later, from around the 1880s on, medical measures of sterilization of the unfit.
How did sterilization come about? This is a very extreme thing for what we think of as an enlightened democracy to propose.
It came about actually because of the concerns over masturbation, which was one of the earlier theories of biological degeneracy. And people who had this erroneous theory that masturbation led to physical or mental ill health tried a variety of ways to prevent it or treat it, including dietary measures, including cold baths and cold enemas and other techniques that make us shudder if we went into detail on it. But those techniques began to shift toward a surgical technique. In the case of males, castration. In the case of females, oophorectomy, the removal of the ovaries. But those techniques were highly dangerous, produced physical changes in the person, and even in the medical society, bitter debates among physicians who felt that this was a betrayal of the medical field. When vasectomies became available in the 1890s, originally for treatment of enlarged prostates, which of course it has no benefit for, but it was an erroneous theory, the vasectomy was then taken over as a strategy to replace castration. So in males, at least, they had found an effective method.
I hate to appear naive, but if masturbation relates as much to the head, I mean,
yes,
sexual gratification does relate,
yes,
as much to the head as to the body, why surgically alter the body? Why not treat it as madness or insanity,
yes,
if you're going to think of it as a perversion?
Because the assumption at that time wasn't as clear as it is today. We know a lot about both psychological development in humans, and we know a lot about medical pathology. But in those days, very little was known. In fact, Lewis Thomas entitled his autobiographical essays The Youngest Science, and he identifies the youngest science as medicine and identifies it as a science beginning in 1938. So it's fairly recent that medicine became less of an art form and more of a science where they could predict why there are diseases and what can really treat them rather than just empirical luck. But in those days, back in the 1700s and 1800s, so little was known about the underlying reasons for both behavior and physical ill health that it was highly speculative. And when this pamphlet appeared around 1700, called the Onania, which introduced for the first time a biological theory of degeneracy in humans, it had attributed to the onanism of the sin of Onan in Genesis 38. And the assumption was that it was self-punishing because Onan, who was supposed to marry Tamar, and who failed to fulfill his duty of consummating the marriage and spilled the seed. The Bible merely describes that this displeased God, so he was slain. And the anonymous author of the Onania said that this implied that onanism or masturbation was its own punishment. And he then went on to list all of what he attributed physical symptoms of onanism, mental symptoms of onanism, and hereditary symptoms of onanism.
I want to leap forward here a little bit. In the United States, vasectomies, sterilization, became written into law at,
yes,
one point. It was done so through the efforts of a man of goodwill.
Yes, yes. Harry Clay Sharp was a physician who was assigned as his first medical job when he got out of Louisville Medical School. He went across the river to Jeffersonville, Indiana, where the state reformatory was. And there he was a very effective advocate for the health of his prisoners. He cleaned up the prison, introduced privies, introduced a good kitchen, asked for and obtained a surgical ward, and used to give pep talks to the prisoners about taking care of themselves. They had a high typhoid rate, a high tuberculosis rate, and after he took over, those infectious diseases dropped. The germ theory was new, he was out of medical school, he was full of enthusiasm for public health, and he did an excellent job in that area. As I was reading his reports to the governor, I noticed that in 1899, among the various surgeries he performed, he had one case of vasectomy. He didn't explain it in that report. But in his subsequent reports, he said that several prisoners had voluntarily come forward and asked to be vasectomized. And he said that while he was using it as a treatment for masturbation, it had the secondary benefit that it sterilized them so that the degeneracy that they had as a consequence of their masturbation would not be passed on to the future. And then in his letters to the governor, he urged that the state make this a law so that all the prisoners who were masturbating or were degenerate by other definitions of medical science would be involuntarily sterilized. At that time, around 1907, he had already sterilized more than 50 individuals. After that, he did well over 200 before the state laws began to be challenged in the courts.
We would think of this as sad and a little perverse, and yet he probably thought it was a triumph of good medicine at his
Yes, he did.
Time.
And he attended the AMA meetings in Atlantic City. His papers were well received. There are many of these published in the AMA proceedings of the early 1900s. He began a postcard campaign around the United States. And largely through his efforts, some 33 states passed compulsory sterilization laws in the United States.
When did the eugenics, the power of the eugenics movement begin to fade?
With the Depression and World War II. In the Depression, for two reasons. One was the advances in genetics, because the assumptions of the hereditarians of that time was that like breeds like. Good people breed good children, bad people breed bad children. And this was false, because genetics doesn't work that way. Perfectly healthy parents can have a child with a genetic defect, and that's well understood. And most of the quote-unquote harmful genes that bring about such genetic defects are spread in a population so that there's no way of identifying them. Each of us has about 8 on the average of such defective genes that would have caused us to be sterilized back in the 1920s.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, if I'm not mistaken, said something that that put at least one of the nails in the coffin of the eugenics movement. That was?
I see one third of the nation ill-housed, ill-clothed, ill-fed. And it was very difficult to blame the victims when one third of the nation was out of work and having hard times. They couldn't blame themselves as genetic failures, and they saw it as a social problem. So did Roosevelt. So did most of us.
So it was the economy, and it was also the intelligence of people in power at that time.
Yes, and as I said, these changes in genetic outlook, where the relationship between genes and characters were seen to be far more complicated than these eugenicists had assumed. Most of the eugenicists were not geneticists. They were psychologists, social reformers, people certainly that we would call intellectuals of a sort or professionals of a sort, physicians and the like, but certainly not the people that that we think of as geneticists.
For this time. Mm-hmm. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Coming forward from that period, there are instances repeated in our own recent history, especially relative to the insane, mm-hmm. that I think we should look at in this context.
Yes.
There is a case, a woman named Carrie Bunk.
Carrie Buck,
which became quite famous.
Yes.
Can you talk about that
yes.
and why it was
yes.
pivotal here?
After some 30-odd states had passed these sterilization laws, a number of them were set back by state courts. And at Cold Spring Harbor, a eugenic record office had been set up in New York on Long Island. And the director of that program composed what he called a model eugenic law that he felt, after consulting legal experts, would meet the equal protection laws and other constitutional guarantees that had been successfully used to challenge sterilization laws. And they looked for a state that wanted to pass a eugenics law that they could give this model eugenic law. And they gave it to the state of Virginia. And Virginia decided to try it out on its very first case. And they selected a woman from Charlottesville, Carrie Buck. Her mother was allegedly feeble-minded. She was considered feeble-minded, and her daughter was considered feeble-minded. And they figured they had a strong case. They then appointed a court advocate for Carrie Buck, and they marched it through all the state courts until they reached the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court listened to all the arguments, and then they made a vote, 8-1, in favor of the state of Virginia, upholding the right of sterilization. And the person who wrote the majority opinion was the most liberal member of the Supreme Court known at that time, and that was Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. And he used in the majority report the argument, three generations of idiots are enough. That's his words. So it's still the law of the land. It's never been repealed by the Supreme Court. But most of the states have abolished their own laws, and the few that still have them rarely do them because there are so many people that would get up in arms if coercive measures were used to sterilize people.
Does anybody know whether Carrie Buck was severely mentally retarded, insane, feeble, whatever that means?
It's very difficult to do a retrospective study of a person's personality when they're no longer alive. But in all likelihood, she was retarded. There have been articles that her daughter was just an average student and not retarded. Very little is known about Carrie Buck's mother and what the basis was for considering her retarded. One of the things that surprised me in reading about Justice Holmes' decision and the views of the court at that time was how easily legislators are bowled over by expert testimony. And certainly at that time, this was a new field of educational psychology. People took it as gospel and thought that any type of testing instrument that showed one person was retarded and another was normal was accurate because the experts weren't going to lie. They may not have lied, but they can be wrong. And I think it's important on the part of legislatures to treat with a certain amount of skepticism expert testimony, because there is very frequently divided opinion among experts on the interpretation of such data.
The shorthand for that is to always remember we don't always know what we're doing, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Dr. Elof Carlson teaches, among other things, cross-disciplinary courses at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. One, an example, is a course he developed in 1968, or designed that year, called Biology, a Humanities Approach. It stresses the use of life sciences for decision making at the individual, family, community, national, and world levels, an exercise in critical thinking on both sides of study, science and philosophy. There are other instances, and I think it's important during this hour to at least tick them off. In our own recent history, Afro-American black women, especially in the South, but elsewhere,
yes,
who've had a number of babies and are on welfare,
yes,
have been thought to, quote, not have sense,
yes,
and have been involuntarily sterilized.
Yes, that has happened. There have probably been, in our own times, the last 10 or 20 years, several hundred such cases. The further back you go, the more there are. I think somewhere less than 100,000 and somewhat more than 30,000 people have been sterilized since that first Indiana law of 1907.
And just a curiosity of mine, if we think back to the 1800s, at the very least, I mean, that's not so far away, women were thought to be generally feeble. Hysterical comes from hysterectomy, comes from
the uterus,
our plumbing.
Yes, sure.
Because we have the menses, we were thought to be moody, not too
yes.
bright, incapable
yes.
of becoming lawyers, doctors, chiefs,
sure.
whatever.
Yes.
Do you think that relates to the eugenics movement? Would a good eugenicist think that women were a little odd as well?
There were attempts to sterilize women in the 1880s and 1890s, they were largely failures because of the high infection rate, because the surgery for women would have been invasive and much more riskier in those days. The assumption of which women to sterilize was based on behavior. If they had psychosis or mental retardation, those were the primary victims for sterilization.
Other groups I have missed?
Well, the one group that doesn't appear in anything before the 20th century are the homosexuals. I'm not sure why that is the case. They're not mentioned in the literature. They're not seen as part of these degenerate groups. I don't think it's because of tolerance. I think it's because they were all in the closet in those days and there was no identification, public identification of them. But certainly in the case of the mentally retarded, who would be obvious by their limited capacities, the psychotics, who would be recognizable by their erratic behavior, criminals certainly by the records they had, and paupers by the neighborhoods they lived in and the dependency on handouts, would have all been recognized. But you can't just recognize homosexuals by walking down the street.
Still in all, I certainly have read of lesbians and gay men who have found themselves shut away in institutions because the social group or their parents or whomever couldn't tolerate them around, said they were nuts,
yes,
and put them away, subjected to electric, yes, shock treatments and the like.
Oh yes, I well remember when I was young reading the newspapers of a practice that the police in New York regularly used to do of hiding out in men's rooms and pretending to be gay and entrapping homosexuals and arresting them. So there was certainly in our own century a very strong anti-gay attitude. But it was never really tied to the eugenics movement in the United States, but it was by Hitler, who, right, of course, looked upon them as a degenerate class.
Is biological determinism related in any way to eugenics?
Oh, it's born out of the eugenics movement. The idea that human behavior in its various forms has a very strong genetic underpinning. And while there may be very vague general characteristics of personality and behavior that can be attributed to these genetic factors, and while there certainly are pathologies of genetic nature that can seriously do damage to the nervous system and make the person incapable, those are the only ones that I, as a geneticist, feel comfortable assigning a genetic role. But so much of our behavior is learned. We learn from the modeling of our behavior to all others around us. Children just drink it up. They're wonderful mimics. And they get a good perception of what they're going to be by looking at their parents, looking at their neighborhood, looking at their peers. And I find that this social environment that creates a child's personality is a far greater influence than any hereditary factors. Some of my colleagues would disagree, but I've never found compelling genetic evidence to the same degree that physical impairments have sound genetic underpinnings for these psychological traits such as aggression or cooperativeness or lying or criminality or just a inability to get along with other people, a sort of crankiness.
There does seem to be a nurture versus nature argument that's still quite alive and well, though.
Yes, and it'll go on for some time because behavior is clearly more complex than the science we have to study it.
Is this sense that you just mentioned that we pass on through our genes all sorts of things, good humor, ill humor, ability to sing along with blue eyes and brown hair, something that impacts us today? Let's say a woman decides to get pregnant by in vitro fertilization.
Yes. But
is this misapprehension going to be in her mind, do you think?
Well, whenever parents do have a medical problem, infertility, a baby born with a birth defect, or even a primary relative, a sibling or a parent with a genetic disorder, there is that feeling of genetic inadequacy, a disturbing feeling. Do I pass it on? What does it mean? And for some people, they will use the options that are available, prenatal diagnosis and the like, to assure having a child that won't repeat a type of hereditary problem that could have had a devastating effect on the family or on the individual who becomes a parent. To that degree, I'm very confident that the knowledge of heredity, the knowledge of the medical options that are available, and the decision of what type of burden one wants to carry in life, what individuals choose to do, will fall into the same category of family planning as how many children should we have for the type of income we have, the type of house we live in, the type of freedoms we want. And there are very few people today who say, well, reproduction should be totally separated from all these conditions that affect us as a married couple. And for that reason, you just don't see people with 14, 16, 18 children the way you did in the 19th century. They are exceptions and rare. So people are practicing family planning by a variety of different methods for a variety of social reasons. And there's no reason why these medical concerns won't enter into those decisions as people's knowledge of it becomes better.
I'm also wondering about a fallout from the eugenics movement. Are we still working in some ways on superstition and fear? And is that also just a part of our makeup as human beings?
I don't think it's a part of our makeup, because I find the whole idea of human nature, both philosophically and theologically, too arbitrary and in conflict with the variety of religions and philosophies we have. We can describe a human condition, but not a human nature, because the human condition tells us 10% of humanity is infertile. One out of five women who attempts to get pregnant will experience a spontaneous abortion. 5% of children will be born with birth defects. About 20% of people will die before their 65th birthday or the like. Those types of things are descriptive. Some of them change from generation to generation. Before the germ theory, 50% of all children born would have died before they reached reproductive maturity. And you had large families in the hope that a few would come through. But today, of course, you don't worry about that. You think it's so exceptional for your child to die before reproductive maturity that you have reasonable confidence, if you have two children, that you'll live to see them have grandkids for you.
Once again, we're talking with Dr. Elof Carlson. The working title for his book, which is in close to final draft form, is The Unfit: From the Sin of Onan to the Smoke of Auschwitz. You have said that our revulsion for eugenics has led us to ignore real problems we don't want to face. One of those is how to deal with genetic disorders.
Yes.
Our science tells us to go after them, fix them, help this child live.
Yes, and I believe in that. That's the golden rule. I think we should. And I don't worry that because we do so, we're spreading the gene in the population and corrupting the future, because I feel that human beings will make these compensations in generations to come. And those who have these high risks will either use prenatal diagnosis, or they will use a smaller family size as a compensation, or they'll adopt. I have faith in the ability of humanity to look at problems when they are real problems and not pseudo problems, and come up with effective responses that aren't coercive. I think as long as we keep the coercion out, that's the important lesson that we've had from The Unfit.
Should there be limits to science, to how far medicine should go You said something that about it being important to permit the natural elimination of gene mutations so that we don't allow their frequency to increase in the population.
Yes. There is that concern, but those types of increases are extremely slow, and you're talking about hundreds of generations or thousands of generations. When I see what has happened in my own field of genetics, just from the years that I've been active professionally, from my graduate school days beginning in 1953 to the present, I have enormous confidence in both the technological changes and the social changes and the changes in values that will address these problems in a humane way that does not involve coercion and does not involve an indifference to the values of others.
Our ability to make sound ethical decisions will grow to meet our advances in technology and science.
One hopes so, yes. Yeah.
Genetic engineering is a subject that can strike fear into the hearts of the common person. Why and is it logical that we be afraid at this point of genetic engineering?
We fear the unknown because there are sometimes exaggerated implications, particularly from science fiction writing. Books like Brave New World, Frankenstein, each generation has a way of looking at the abuses that science can bring. And certainly progress always leaves a wake of discontent with it. They coexist. And with good reason, we should go cautiously and examine all new technologies. I don't mind the delays. I don't mind the opposition as a scientist when new technologies are introduced. I think it's healthy in a democracy. But I have confidence that as the successes of these technologies become apparent, as in vitro fertilization, where you find women who've been infertile for 10 or 12 years and have tried all sorts of things, and finally this new technology brings a child, and you take a look at that healthy child, and you look at the parents, and you see that sense of wonder and miracle and satisfaction that has come to their lives, you realize that there is something inherently wrong in the terminology we use when we call them test tube babies. Why don't we call it an oviduct bypass? That's more of a benign description of it. But as soon as we use our vocabulary, test tube babies, we impose on that married couple and their child an unnaturalness, and yet neither the parents nor the child nor the physicians involved see it in those terms. And in the long run, neither will society.
What can genetic engineering do now? I mean, you've taken a look at what our worst fear is. What can it do now, and where do you think its future lies?
Well, there is a project that's being federally funded by the taxpayers called the Human Genome Project, which is attempting to identify the location of every gene in our 46 chromosomes that constitute the biological basis for our individuality. And that project should be finished early in the 21st century. And it's under rapid development at this time. More than 4,000 single gene defects that cause medical problems have been identified, more than 90% of them since the end of World War II. We estimate that there are about 100,000 genes that are present at fertilization in a cell that determines the biology of the future individual. And analyzing the location of these, isolating each of these, sequencing the chemical components, the nucleotides of the DNA of these genes, will be worked out. And I find the future a very optimistic one, not only for science but for society from a gaining of this knowledge. Because I'm very Baconian. I believe that the more we know, the more we can use that knowledge, and that knowledge is not only power, knowledge is liberation. It's liberation from fear, it's liberation from ignorance, it's liberation from superstition. And to take charge of our lives, we have to have information. That is the function of a democracy, and we are a democratic society. So I'm in full sympathy with the uses of our tax money in this direction. And I think the medical benefits, the number of genetic therapies for sick children that will enable them to live and to function are going to be very powerful omens or icons in the public support of this program. And for scientists, I think there are lots of surprises because life is enormously complex, and we only know snippets of it. And I suspect that from a full study of this, it'll be a treasure trove. It'll be like having the Dead Sea Scrolls and working them out.
We're always hoping for such
yes.
a thing. Aren't we going to come up against ourselves exceedingly hard if genetic engineering gets us to the point by the 21st century where we can predict and alter the fate of a genetic disability or genetic disease at the same time when the Earth's population is doubling and redoubling, what, every 41 years or something
yes,
like
something
that?
Yes, something like that, yeah.
Aren't we going to come smack up against ourselves?
We do, and yet at the same time, when you say the world population is doubling every 41 years, if you went on a country-by-country basis through the 160 members of the United Nations, you would find that in some countries the population has already reached zero population growth, some are actually declining. And if you asked why is it that different countries have different population rates, you'll find that in many instances these are economic and social factors of opportunity where family planning is widely used and accepted, as in our own country. And when that happens, the population dips. I don't feel that just because third world countries have a growing population, that they will have an indefinite growing population. I'm very confident that the introduction of democracy into countries that are either theocracies or autocracies of various sorts where people are manipulated can change far faster than the population doubling time in those countries. So I look forward to that. And considering the way the Soviet Empire collapsed and the rapid changes toward democracy and the yearning for this around the world, I'm confident that the 21st century is going to bring dramatic reductions in the population of the world without any coercion.
We didn't think we could stop on a dime, did we? And in some ways, the breakdown of the Berlin Wall
yes.
showed us that some things can't stop on a dime.
Yes.
I mean, the dime certainly continues to roll. But
yes.
Yeah. This is Conversations. We're talking with Dr. Elof Carlson. I want to take a look with you at your cross-disciplinary studies and work with your students. First of all, the obvious, why did you think it was important in 1968 to create such a course, and what did you hope to achieve? Yeah.
Kennedy's assassination began the thinking in my mind because I saw the transition from the optimism of students that the individual counts. Whoever wrote Kennedy's speech, perhaps Kennedy himself, had this view that the individual counted and that we could do a lot as individuals. And then there was this cynicism during the Vietnam War, this guns and butter philosophy, the feeling that the individual was just overwhelmed and the state was more powerful in taking over our lives. And I looked around and saw a number of problems. The civil rights movement and the ideas of racism and inferiority, the intelligence quotient or IQ controversy, and the idea of typing the poor or minority groups as inferior in mental ability. And I looked at various books and theories of human aggression and the like, and I kept asking myself, why do these people who are mostly not geneticists keep invoking a genetic basis for all these traits? Is there any truth or merit to it? So I began studying unfamiliar sources. I began reading vital statistics. I wanted to find out what the human condition really was. And the more I read in these unfamiliar sources, the more I realized that there was a need to educate the public, particularly because I realized the decisions that are often made by businesses, by school districts, by churches, by federal and state and local governments is based on people who are not biology majors. And we can't expect and do not want biology majors to be the persons who make the decisions for us. And I felt that if the general public makes these decisions, and many of them, if not most of them, have a liberal arts education in college, then it's the duty of scientists to make the future decision makers informed about the implications of the science they learn. The tradition in my generation was to separate science from all values and social concerns. So it was taught as a contained, pure subject, and students frequently hated it because they just saw it as memorizing facts and getting out of exams and then dumping it out of their heads as fast as they could.
Doesn't relate to my life.
Exactly.
Sure.
So I related it to their lives. And that was the purpose of that course. And I consider it one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life, to get up in front of 500 students every year and realize that 10, 20 years down the line, I could have an influence on their life by conveying all the wonderful as well as the potentially harmful things that can come out of the science I love.
And you think of this as an exercise in critical thinking?
Yes, I do, because I think in a democracy, you need informed citizens, and therefore we have to train ourselves to think outside our disciplines. We have to think of what we are doing as it is connected to all other knowledge. I believe knowledge is just one big connected web.
Should we take the work you're doing at SUNY and put it into high schools? As far down as grammar schools, when can people start doing what you're doing with your college students?
I think parents and teachers can do that at every level, and of course each level has certain capacities to learn, and good teachers recognize what their students can and cannot absorb at a different age. But thoughtful teachers who think about this will be able to introduce it. And certainly citizenship training begins as soon as the child begins to learn to talk.
This is a very different question, but what are you most afraid of about your society?
The embracing of fear leading to delay or denial of what science can introduce to address problems that have long been neglected, and then they will continue to be neglected.
Do you think this is basically the fear of the Luddite? It's a machine, I don't understand it, I don't want to deal with it, or translate it into any other context?
No, I think it's a fear based more on burnt fingers of the past.
Ah.
And when you learn that people of goodwill, liberals, educated people, social reformers could have led to something as disastrous as the smoke of Auschwitz, and that while it may take evil people to take good ideas and corrupt them, I think it makes people fear the idea of new technologies, whatever they are, because they feel these can do even more damage in the hands of evil people.
Keep the door closed, we won't have to look at it.
Yeah.
Dr. Carlson, I want to thank you for joining us on Conversations. The book may not come out under this title, but keep a lookout for it if we've piqued your interest. This is Dr. Elof Carlson. His working title is The Unfit, From the Sin of Onan to the Smoke of Auschwitz. You can find him if you want to take a cross-disciplinary course at the Department of Biochemistry and Cell Biology, State University of New York at Stony Brook, where he is a distinguished teaching professor. Thank you for an interesting hour.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll join me again next week. I'm Susan McInnes.